This is Studio 809 Podcasts, informing, connecting, and empowering the residents of the Pikes Peak region.
Welcome to Peak Environment, the Pikes Peak region's podcast about environmental stewardship.
You might think data centers are all about tetrawatts and millions and billions of gallons of water, but there really is so much more to this subject. I'm excited to turn this episode of Peak Environment over to one of our content partners, 350 Colorado Springs, and a really interesting conversation between Sierra Guerrero and Riz Benuelos.
California-based developer Raiden specializes in technology and real estate, and they're the company that's working on what they consider to be a strategic repurposing of the former Intel microchip facility next to Garden of the Gods. They're planning to turn this facility into a data center that is projected to use 50 megawatts of power. Raiden has held two community meetings recently where they answered questions from the public, but ultimately informed us that this is a private transaction and we don't have a real say in the matter. In this episode, we're going to dive into data centers, what they are, how they affect us, and what we can do about what's happening locally with data center development. I'm Sierra Guerrero. I'm with 350 Colorado, which is an environmental nonprofit here in the Springs.
I'm Riz Benuelos. I'm also with 350 Colorado here in the Colorado Springs chapter. Happy to be here today talking with you about data centers and what we can do to organize against this and protect our future.
So let's zoom out and talk about some of the big picture stuff, because this data center business happened really fast. It sort of crept up on us until a couple years ago. I wasn't quite sure what a data center was, hadn't heard too much about it. And now what we're understanding is the physical infrastructure of the cloud, which turns out is not something that's in the ethers, is starting to affect us.
We're in this moment where we came from pretty small data centers up until the last 5 years, and now we have hyperscale and more particularly AI data centers, which are much larger and much more resource intensive, and they are exploding around the U.S. and around the world and really threatening our communities and our global community by pushing off our climate targets. Maybe just a question to get the ball rolling is, how is the deregulation of neoliberalism, the explosion of inequality in the past 10 years, and the climate crisis all converging in data centers? And we're just going to spend some time disentangling the connections of these intersecting crises.
During these community meetings that I've been attending with Raiden and Project Taurus, one of the things that's become really clear to me is that a lot of the language around why we need this additional data center infrastructure is for national security. It's reminding me so much of the Patriot Act post 9/11, manufacturing consent for, in this case, exponentially more mass surveillance. And now AI weapons and other counterterrorism measures, which, just like when the Patriot Act was put out, the definition of terrorism has vastly been expanded.
Mm-hmm. With Trump just a month or so ago saying that environmental activists are terrorists. And it's really interesting to bring this conversation back to 2001, back to after 9/11 happened, because really I think that that was the beginning of the trajectory that we are on now with data centers, because before 9/11, a lot of these policies that have shaped surveillance, like the Patriot Act, were being contemplated. After 9/11, there was this whole attitude and shift towards more surveillance. And at that point in 2001 is when Google began gathering data undetectably to sell to their business partners. And this was the beginning of surveillance capitalism. This has continued us on a trajectory where all of the ways that we use the internet are being collected in these data centers, and then they're using algorithms to predict our behaviors so that they can sell more things to us. And not only that, but these prediction models are being used to subtly reward us or stunt us to shape our behaviors and stealing our autonomy in the future. And they've done this, not letting the public know, by doing it in really subtle ways. And now we are at this point where AI is exploding and it's gathering our data at stoplights. There's an app where they can track license plates. And that's one of the most worrying things about this AI explosion, the way that it's very intimately tied to surveillance.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Google, because when I was a teenager, my dream was to work for specifically Google. I thought that would be a great paying career, and I was really interested in technology as a kid. But I'm coming to understand more Google's role in how things have played out. I'm reading from this book called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism right now. Google was the pioneer of surveillance capitalism in thought and practice, the deep pocket for research and development, and the trailblazer in experimentation and implementation. But it is no longer the only actor on this path. Surveillance capitalism quickly spread to Facebook and later to Microsoft. So, you know, what's really interesting about surveillance capitalism is initially this was about predictive behavioral modeling. There is a thing called behavioral futures markets, and a lot of these surveillance capitalists have grown wealthy by trading on our behaviors, our future behaviors. They eventually figured out that not only can they find out what we're doing all the time, but they can actually utilize this predictive behavioral modeling to shape our behaviors at scale. This quote here, with this reorientation from knowledge to power, it is no longer enough to automate information flows about us. The goal is now to automate us. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing at the community meeting, the COO of Raiden, Jason Green, say to us over and over again, a lot of these lines that are almost programmed into our psyches at this point, AI is here. There's nothing we can do to stop it. This is the path of progress. It's that sort of myth of linear progress and technology that's supposed to lead us to,
right, to an unreality. We, within Western thought and within the US, have really accepted this idea that all of this is just an inevitable consequence of development, of digital technology, of our progress on this linear path that really has no single landing point, but it is one of continuous extraction. It's one based on exponential growth, and it's really a dream of the elite that has no landing place. There is not an earth that can support this unchecked growth. And it's this crazy idea that we've become so succumbed to, that all of the things that are going on with data centers, the way that our data privacy is being used, is just inevitable. And at these community hearings, like you're saying, it's a private business deal. The city has a say because they're doing different things to support the infrastructure of the project. They have to approve the zoning and so on and so forth. And the feeling at these meetings is like, oh, we're doing the thing, like we're having a community gathering, we're getting people's inputs, and everyone is screaming and everyone is so upset because No, it doesn't matter what they say. There's not a way that they will actually be listened to. We don't want this here. And that doesn't matter in this formal process. It's just a tick off of the to-do list. We consulted the community, and this is just what it's going to be.
Yeah, it's almost as though the community meetings are to give the facade of community input.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking about what you were saying about the techno-utopian unreality, that a lot of these people whose ontological worldview is rooted in this fantasy of transcending limits. And it's strange because to a lot of us, it seems obvious that these data centers and also the power needed to power them are not in line with material reality. But mm-hmm. these people don't seem all that concerned with that.
And that lack of concern is something that Bruno Latour talks about too. He says that the elites have been so thoroughly convinced that there would be no future life for everyone that they have decided to get rid of all the burdens of solidarity as fast as possible. Hence, deregulation. They have decided that a sort of gilded fortress would have to be built for those, a small percentage, who would be able to make it through, hence the explosion of inequalities. And they have decided that, to conceal the crass selfishness of such a flight out of our shared world, they would have to reject, absolutely, the threat at the origin, crisis, headlong flight, hence the denial of climate change. So there's an understanding among the elite who are chasing this fantasy, this unreality of continuous technological development and the explosion of neoliberalism and the privatization of public goods and deregulation and more sacrifice zones that go hand in hand with authoritarian governments is part of amounting all of the resources and money that they can so that there will be a small group who could survive the climate crisis. And to make that a possibility, like Bruno Latour is saying, the explosion of inequality, so that there is a disenfranchised and exploitable group of people that makes this flight towards progress possible. In the 70s, when there was all of these oil companies paying for propaganda, for climate denialist propaganda that they've always known, but that can't be shared with the public. It's been used to divide us. Climate change didn't used to be a partisan issue. We all wanted clean water and clean air and a planet that was livable. Environmental regulation used to not be something that divided people politically. But all of this money enables this deep extraction and this unreality. It's very intentional. The ways that it disenfranchises communities to be able to advocate against governments that threaten their future, the ways that AI chat boxes have replaced real human connection, real solidarity, that broad bases, civil society networks, that the backbone of democracy rely on. When people stop going to another human or another friend to ask for advice and they start replacing that human interaction with a chat box, even having romantic relationships with a chat bot, that dilutes the power that we have in human connectivity and the power we have to resist things like AI data centers in our community, but also more broadly, militarization, ICE taking our neighbors. This is all happening at once, and it's all so connected, and it's all so intentional.
Oh my gosh, so much came up when you were talking. You said this thing when we were preparing for this episode that I loved about the techno fantasy. It's like eating a meal that makes you more hungry. It's like there's no point at which we're satiated if we agree that this is the story.
Right.
And it's all storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a really good question to keep asking ourselves is, what story are we telling about who we are and what is possible in our future?
Right. And what story are we telling about what is just a consequence of human society versus what are we actually choosing and what do we want and where can we exercise our agency? Where can we find those pockets where surveillance capitalism hasn't corralled us into a set future or just realize that's bullshit? And that we do have power and we have autonomy and we have something very special in our humanity. And that's our imagination and our ability to say, oh, I'm going to eat a meal that will fill me and one that I've grown in my garden and that my grandchildren's 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 can also eat. You know, we have to do that together.
Another thing that was coming up when you were talking was how these technologies disproportionately impact people. And I've noticed with data centers, they're getting really good at co-opting the language of sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost no attention paid to where the materials for these computer chips come from, who is affected by the extraction of those materials, as well as the manufacturing of those materials.
Mm-hmm.
And it's reminding me so much of green capitalism, green colonialism, where we've reduced it down to carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think that it's fair to say that this data center boom is the newest frontier of environmental injustice. And like you were hinting at, it can't be disentangled from the exploitative global trade structures where the global south is extracted from, is left with all of the pollution and the harm to their bodies, to their land, to their futures also. Doesn't just go away just because a company decides that they've extracted all that they want from a place. It's a legacy that is entangled in the collection of these materials in the data centers. But also, if we look at where they are being set up around the U.S., it's often in communities of color and communities that have been financially neglected, that are low income. And that's not a coincidence. People can say that it's because of cheap land, but it's also because it intersects with the ways that inequality has shaped political power and also what bodies are deemed exploitable, are deemed invaluable.
Here in Colorado, a couple of the data center projects that come to mind are Puebloplex, which is a huge industrial site that's being developed. And Pueblo has long been an environmental sacrifice zone. We put coal plants down there. They're wanting to put nuclear plants down there. These data centers are manufacturing consent not only for surveillance and AI weapons, but also for the extension of coal plants around the country, as well as the acceleration of nuclear energy and the deregulation of nuclear energy.
Right. And this chase for small modular reactors, SMRs, that actually haven't really been successful in the world. It's just another pouring money into a dangerous techno fantasy to power yet another techno fantasy.
Yeah. And words like sustainable and clean I hope that we start to come to more nuanced understandings of how these words are being used. Because last year in Colorado, nuclear energy was officially deemed clean by the state. And it is not. Not at the point of extraction, not at the point of power generation, and certainly not at the point of what we do with the waste.
Yeah, and if carbon dioxide is the only pollutant that we're looking at, then sure, but we're not. And we're also not looking at the fact that nuclear energy isn't, we can't disentangle that from nuclear weapons. If we go back to when the U.S. was creating atomic bombs, the first atomic bomb that went off was in Los Alamos. It was in New Mexico. And it was a colonial fantasy of a land that was empty. No, there was communities there. There was people and homes that were severely contaminated by the radioactive explosion. Generations that were affected by uranium contamination, not to mention the indigenous Diné people of the Four Corners region, whose land and bodies were used to create these weapons. And that is still ongoing. That is still part of what nuclear energy is.
We're lucky here in Colorado Springs that this project is located next to Garden of the Gods and some very affluent communities who have the time and the resources to fight back against it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the places that these centers are popping up, to your point, do not have that kind of access. And even in these community meetings, I'm hearing a lot of, why don't you go build this in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah. You can do it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm of the belief. I'm of the desire that they wouldn't be anywhere.
Yeah.
But also the fact that it's next to Garden of the Gods, which is this beautiful and magical place in Colorado Springs that is a corridor for our wildlife, that is a sacred site, is also just preposterous. Really sad. There, while we were at the community meeting, there's a young woman who asked very passionately if the impacts to the wildlife had been explored, what putting a wall up in this corridor would do. And he basically avoided the question.
He didn't know.
Yeah.
And a lot of the questions that were asked, the answer was effectively, well, we'll find out once we build the thing.
Oh, and we'll publish the studies once it's approved, because it has to go through all these bureaucratic processes that really just, in effect, minimize transparency.
And so that's why I wanted to frame this conversation around the zoom out. How did we get here? Because we're at this place where you can bring as many facts as you can possibly gather, but shooting facts at one another, they have their own facts. They have the facts that their company and their investors, by the way, one of their investors is a venture capital firm founded by the former CFO of Palantir, which is named after the Palantiri, which are the scrying stones that spied on the hobbits. And basically tracked and controlled them throughout Lord of the Rings. So as many facts as you show up with, they have a different worldview. And figuring out how to navigate interacting with these people has been challenging, because it's clear if I say I'm concerned about the water use, they're like, well, that shouldn't be a concern.
Mm-hmm. They're operating on their own set of facts. And that's also something that, well, first to the water issue. All right, circular water, will only use 200,000 gallons while we're filling up the system. Don't know how many times that will need to be replaced, how many leaks there will be. That might be more water efficient, but it's not energy efficient. Fossil fuels power the data center, power that water recycling system.
There's all these externalized costs that are not even being considered or brought into the public awareness.
And then the public awareness is being very intentionally sheathed under a blanket of ignorance. I will make that worse, essentially, by creating a bunch of AI slop, a bunch of like content that is made for instant gratification. It changes the use of communication, where communication is to be primarily used for substance and argumentation. Once it becomes instant gratification, it takes away our thinking processes, the ways that social media is not perfect, but in the ways that we get our news from social media, content that actually has power to change us to something that keeps us dim and occupied while the elite go and run off towards this fantasy that's powered by our future.
It's doing behavioral modification and engineering. It knows how to hijack our brain to give us those instantaneous results that we crave. My hot take, as someone who's worked in marketing for a while, is that LLMs, large language models like ChatGPT and image generators and video generators and stuff like that, are essentially the marketing arm of AI to get us friendly with it.
Mm-hmm.
And to form this kinship
to make it
with
normal.
It, to normalize it and to sell us on the idea that AI is beneficial to us in some way.
Oh, it gives me a yummy little treat for my brain.
I've heard some of my friends have said it makes me so much more efficient. And so that question I ask, at what point is there more to life than optimizing ourselves to do more work, to create more profit for shareholders?
And not to mention how that idea of making yourself more efficient, more profitable, but also this reliance on AI for research. We already know that AI, it has its problems. It will give you misinformation and not realize it. Everyone's like, oh, well, it's just in the beginning stages. It'll get better. But that might not necessarily be true if companies do what companies do and they try to maximize their profits. It's cheaper, it's easier to not work out those bugs, so it might actually get worse, you know? By relying on AI for our knowledge production, AI becomes a sort of central holder of knowledge. And that gives it so much power, because the democratization of knowledge is originally what we thought and hoped that the internet would be, but it's been co-opted by surveillance capitalism, like you were talking about, also being co-opted by the ease of just looking something up instantaneously on AI, and it gives AI all of the power of our curiosity and answers if we continue to rely on it solely.
It's like this is the homogenization of knowledge.
Right.
And it's an erasure of everything that falls outside of these techno hyper-capitalist.
The people who program the chatbots, they're not just unbiased.
Yeah.
They have all of the biases of the people and the institutions and the epistemologies that have created them. There's studies that have shown that they're racist, they're patriarchal. They don't exist out of the oppressive structures that have created them.
Yeah, they don't exist in a vacuum. This idea that AI is a tool and that tools and technologies are neutral. Well, nothing is neutral. Everything exists contextually.
Mm-hmm. And AI just puts all knowledge out of context. I just remember being in middle school and high school, and it's like, always look at the author. Was it a man or a woman? What is the title? Yeah, context clues is like how you develop your critical thinking. It's also a very useful tool for making sense of the world. If we act like context doesn't matter, what are we losing? And is it worth it for efficiency, for ease, for not having to think so hard?
Yeah, because if we lose that context, a lot of times we're losing the real ability to participate in life, in the place that we live.
One question I have that we didn't get to go into so much is, for the environmental folks out there, why is militarization and the climate crisis so disentangled? The U.S. is the largest institutional polluter. Data centers get to bypass regulations because they are supporting our national security. Why have we not explored that connection more? And what can we do to bring that to the front of our movement, to recognize that human and non-human lives are most impacted by these two crises that are so interlinked? And also, what is violence, and what violence do we assume is okay, that's inherent, that is just a product of our progress? And how can we question that notion and create a future that doesn't have to be as violent as this one?
What is freedom? And who is being made safe by all this surveillance? Okay, so we're going to zoom back in. Come back down to Colorado and talk about some of the recent legislation that was being proposed in this state. And one of them was this bill, HB 1030, which essentially provided 100% tax breaks for data centers in Colorado for up to 30 years. It was not passed.
HB 1030, these 100% sales tax cuts were created and really supported under the notion that if we have tax cuts, that will bring data centers in. And despite losing money on sales tax, communities would gain money by taxing the revenue of these data centers. Ideally, that money would come back into the communities. And legislation like this has been passed in 35 states the last time I checked around the country. And also around the country, we're seeing this logic absolutely fail.
Yeah, some of these states are seeing incredible losses after granting these tax breaks.
Texas had a cost projection for the data center tax break that was $130 million. Virginia has a similar program that now costs them $1.6 billion per year. That is more than the state's entire judicial department budget. And Virginia is now actively trying to reduce these credits. We are being sold an idea that these data centers will benefit us intellectually, productivity-wise, or monetarily. And over again, we see that that's not true. We see them coming into communities, further disenfranchising them, polluting them with diesel generators and noise and light, and really degrading people's ability to live well in their community. And it's under the guise that it's going to benefit us. And it's just, it's absolutely not true.
And they often don't bring very many jobs. That's one of their main talking points, is right. Job creation.
What is so interesting that we came up with while we were lobbying against HB 1030 was that the labor unions were actually advocating for this bill. because this idea or the data center will come in, and then construction workers will have a job for around 2 years, and then there will be no more construction work, right? But to construction workers, all of their jobs are temporary. That's the nature of the work, right? So for them, it actually is beneficial, but for...
in the short term.
Yeah, in the short term. But for everyone else and for all of the white collar jobs that AI is replacing in finance and so on and so forth, like, it's not going to benefit people in terms of jobs. And if anything, it's going to further degrade the middle class, which is yet another backbone of democracy that AI threatens. Countries that do not have a middle class have a much more difficult time overthrowing authoritarian regimes or not allowing their governments to backslide into authoritarianism.
Yeah, because when people don't have that access and time privilege.
Exactly. It's like a sense of what you need to advocate for. You need to be able to advocate to pay your bills, to have access to childcare or things to survive. But the middle class has an opportunity to be able to advocate for enriching their lives, for protecting freedoms that go beyond the basic needs of food and water, and so on and so forth.
Listening to Alex Valdez and some of the other individuals in the hearing for 1030, it was easy to see the huge differences in worldview that are present at the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Even in that relatively small group, it was clear that many of us are thinking very differently about this. And so truly, I'm not sure how much headway we'll make sticking to the supposed facts. I'll introduce some clips here from that hearing. I think you'll find them enlightening.
We can't stop tech. We can't stop where we're going as a society. Everything is electronic. Everything. More automation coming. And we are a state that is increasingly poor. It was not a poor state when I grew up here. It has become increasingly poor since the mid-90s. We have no money to spend on the things that our peers in this country are spending on. And that is starting to show. And the reason I believed in this work was because I was reading in the New York Times and in the Wall Street Journal that these hyperscalers, Google, Meta, Facebook, I guess Meta is Facebook, Amazon, you name it, they were making these massive investments. There were these articles about hundreds of billions here, hundreds of millions here, hundreds of millions here, gigawatts of new renewable energy, transmission projects, reinvigorating communities by reopening shuttered power plants. And why? Just to serve the needs that we already have, because I know I'm probably going to use DoorDash later, and we're on Zoom, and we have smartphones, and it's what we've chosen. You know, the opposition here was called, quote-unquote, the Enviros. I just gave my farewell speech as the chair of this committee. I earned that chair, and I earned it by being a astute and competent environmentalist who was able to pass over 70 bills in the subject area. And so to have the accusation being that this bill was bad for the environment was ghastly to me as an individual. But it worked on some. 2 weeks ago, I was in Texas. They have 630,000 megawatts of new business coming onto their grid. Did you hear that? 630,000 megawatts. Some of it's Wells Fargo that just left my district. Some of it's TIA Cref just left my district. We got to turn the corner. And what this strike below promised to do was not only meet the environmental needs of the future, and I want to be clear about a few things on that. Number one, water was never in the question here. All the mailers, lies. We never allowed for water usage. It was a closed loop mandate. My fear is that we'll look back in future years and say, look at this opportunity we had to change and make a generational change that would have invested in the generation and the transmission. It would have invested in the battery that I'm sure a lot of you want to have in your garage. Unfortunately, we have to continue with the status quo, and that's not good for us, because that means Wyoming wins and Texas wins. No offense to them, but I'm playing and rooting for the home team here. And I really want to see us fix our issues that we have with energy and embrace a business, any business, that will make things better for us as the citizens of Colorado.
Representative Sloan.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. I did actually want to make a few comments. Mr. Chair, I appreciate all the work that you've put into this. I really do. I know that it's been a ton. And I hope that we recognize that though this bill may be PI'd today, data centers aren't a topic that's probably going anywhere anytime soon. And many of the things that you said, I think, are exactly right. As I sit here with a smartphone and a tablet on Zoom and all the things, data centers have a lot of money that they bring with them. I was on a webinar earlier today with an organization, and they were speaking from the D.C. area. The largest data center county in the United States is Loudoun County, Virginia. Unbelievable amounts of money that go there. I don't know that we need to fear data centers as much as I feel like a lot of people that I talk to fear data centers.
Representative Joseph.
I knew that I was a no from the beginning because of the importance of not having a data center in the state without extreme strong regulations. And I truly believe that Colorado should not continue approving data centers without extremely strong regulations. And frankly, I believe we need a moratorium on new data centers until we fully understand their long-term impact on our communities, or workers, or water, or energy grid, and our fiscal future. We're being asked to move quickly on an industry that promises jobs, innovation, and economic development. But we need to ask a deeper question: development for who and at what cost? In the short terms, it may appear beneficial, but in the long term, we risk creating a fiscal cliff where corporations receive substantial public subsidies while communities are left carrying the burden of infrastructure cost, energy demand, water consumption, and environmental mitigation. That is not sustainable economic development. That is transfer of public risk into private hands. Before Colorado expands in this industry further, we need strong guardrails. Colorado has an opportunity to lead with foresight instead of reacting after the damage is done. We should not allow ourselves to become so desperate for the promise of economic development that we fail to ask whether the deal is actually good for working families, taxpayers, and future generations.
Representative Wug.
A lot of people just generally very scared about the future with data centers here and what it might do. So I just want to acknowledge that. I think you're right. I think there was a lot of misinformation out there as well. And just want to thank you for the work.
There's one where he's like something about stopping the future. I think that it's not about stopping where we are going, but questioning the trajectory that we are on and what trajectory we want to go on. And we need to carefully ask who is choosing and not assume that this is the future that is right for everyone. This is not a future that brings future. This is a future that forecloses the possibilities of the next generations living well. Because data centers require a lot of energy. And historically, we've seen when a new, more efficient, cheaper energy like solar now is, has been introduced to the market, it hasn't actually replaced older ones. Oil and gas didn't replace coal. It just added to the market. And data centers represent a threat to all of the progress that we've made by just making renewables additive rather than replacing fossil fuel infrastructure that is driving climate change.
Yeah, that's called the Jevons paradox, where the renewable energy does not replace the fossil fuels and only stacks on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these data centers are having to construct their own power plants or extend the life of coal plants, or like we were talking about, move into nuclear.
And how like the Trump's whole revival of coal around the country is so intimately tied with the energy demands of data centers.
Do you want to talk about 102?
Yeah. So SB 102 was the data center bill that we were advocating for. It would actually provide a lot of protections for the environment and disincentivize, to an extent, data centers in Colorado. It would have made Colorado a national leader in terms of regulations on data centers, didn't have tax cuts, and yeah, it enforced the data centers to have to be responsible for their energy. Data centers' energy demands would have to be in line with the Colorado Clean Energy Plan, or they would have to be even better than that plan.
Yeah, and shout outs to Kathy Kipp for spearheading that effort.
Yeah.
Neither of these bills passed.
Too contentious.
We'll see what happens next year. My thoughts are that between now and then, a lot more people will have a lot more thoughts and ideas about data centers and how they affect us. A year in this timeline with how quickly these data centers are popping up is a long time.
To get Project Taurus through, Raiden will ultimately, that will go through City Council. And they also will have to get the rezoning required to be approved by City Council. So City Council is a big power player. And what we can do to influence them to not approve these plans is reach out to them. You can set up a one-on-one with your City Council member, or just show up to a meeting. And when there is time for a public comment, you can express your opinions and hope that something lands.
You can send a comment to Colorado Springs City Planner Daniel Sexton. It is daniel.sexton@coloradosprings.gov. And we'll have that linked in the show notes.
And if you would like to join the environmental coalition that is organizing against the Taurus Data Center for good policy and against policy that threaten our future, you can join meetings from 5:45 to 6:45 every other Thursday in the Penrose Library, usually in the Pine Room. But you can always follow us on Instagram at 350 Colorado Springs to keep up to date with what we're doing. We'd love to have you join us in this movement and in solidarity for a better future.
We're going to be having various action hours where you can come out and discuss, write something with us, and writing about these issues helps you further develop your own ideas and communication skills when it comes to data centers and fossil fuels. So that's just an added benefit. I want to mention, too, there's a group I've been learning a lot from when it comes to data center resistance, and that is Honor the Earth. They have a website, and there's a whole tab on data center resistance that you can check out. It's really helpful for that zoom out lens. Another invitation is to get more involved in your community on the ground. Like Riz was saying, surveillance capitalism backs us into these corners and engineers our behavior. If you want to join 350 Colorado Springs at our monthly in-person meetings, they are every third Wednesday at 5 p.m. held at Poor Richards downtown.
Hope to see you there, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks.
Region, there's no shortage of activities. Whether you're experiencing breathtaking parks or magnificent works of art, if you're getting fashionable at a film festival or fresh at a farmer's market, if you want to hear the sweet sounds of a symphony or the smooth shred of a Stratocaster, look no further than Peak Radar, your one-stop shop for all events in the Pikes Peak region, your free source for viewing and posting events. So no matter how you engage with our beautiful region, visit peakradar.com and get plugged into the peak.